This is Ann Cox, and welcome to Moving Mindfully. Here we delve into the psychology behind physical activity, and we talk about the many different paths to getting the most satisfaction and enjoyment out of moving our bodies. I also try to connect the research or the science behind physical activity to the actual practice itself. Let's begin today's episode.
Hi, everyone. We have Mandy Shankemeyer here with us today, and we're going to talk about body image, but also physical activity and the really complex intersection between the two, really. Mandy is an outdoor educator, and she's a yoga teacher, and I'm really excited to talk to Mandy today because we just completed our 200-hour yoga teacher training over the past summer. So let's get started. Mandy, welcome.
Thank you.
So I talked about this several times during our yoga training, I feel like, and you kept saying, you know, you would have such interesting things to say about body image and that you were interested in talking about it and having this conversation. Can you tell us why you think it's so important that we talk about body image?
I think first and foremost, to acknowledge that it is an issue in today's society, and it's an issue that affects all genders, but in particular, it tends to affect women and young girls a lot more. And so I think first acknowledging that it is an issue, but also that it's prevalent and it has some pretty negative consequences for those that deal with pressures about body image or bad body image. And so discussing it kind of opens it up and it puts it out there so that we can acknowledge it and then begin to address the underlying causes of the issue. It's not just something that affects somebody mentally. It can go into different parts of their life. So it affects academics, work ethic, and really just takes up a lot of space in the brain.
Yeah, totally. I think we should pause here and talk about what the heck body image is. So, you know, I do research on body image, and, you know, I think one of the simplest definitions is what you think and how you feel about your body. And I would say, I think probably the average person would agree with that definition, that that's what they think about. And largely, that centers on how the body appears. You know, how we feel, what we think about the body, we're talking about how the body appears. We'll go a little bit more into other aspects of it later, but I think that gives a little bit of a common definition about what we're talking about. Would you agree with that definition?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what's really important to note there is that it's not necessarily how the body actually looks, but it's your perception of how your body looks, how you feel in your body.
That is such a good point. That's the perceptual dimension of body image. Yes, it doesn't matter. And it's all perception, and it's all just your reality is how you feel and how you perceive things. I know you come from a female perspective, so you bring that to the equation. When do you think these problems or concerns about body image or perhaps negative body image really begin for girls?
I think it's way younger than we realize. I think growing up, young girls are constantly being exposed to talk about dieting because it's in the media, it's in their families. They're hearing it probably from when they can understand language. And so they're raised with this idea and this focus on their bodies. We constantly compliment little girls on their cute dresses and their shoes and how adorable they are and how they look. And so they grow up with a focus on that, whether or not they're aware of it or the people around them are aware of it.
It's so true, right? I often say when I'm teaching my classes that we value girls and women for how they look, and we value boys for what they do and what they achieve. And particularly with physical accomplishments, it's what the body looks like for a girl, and it's what the body does for a boy. I'm thinking about a recent Slater and Tigeman article. I want to give a shout out to Slater and Tigeman, just showed that 6 to 9 year old girls begin internalizing sexualized images of women. That is, they start to prefer more sexualized images of girls and women. And 54% of the girls in their 2016 study wished that they had a smaller body. 54% of 6 to 9 year old girls. And so you're absolutely right. This starts, you know, if not earlier, it certainly starts by school age.
Absolutely. And in Brené Brown's book, let's see, which one do I have? I thought it was just me, but it isn't. She notes that in one American survey, 81% of 10-year-old girls had already dieted at least once, which is a very alarming statistic.
I am so glad you brought that because I was looking for that information earlier. Yes, I knew it was high, but I didn't remember it being quite that high. Yeah, and I wouldn't say that things have probably gotten any better since that statistic was published.
No, this is, what, 2007? And I would almost guess that it's gotten worse.
Yeah. Do you have any memories of, you talk about this idea of that we become, I might be putting words in your mouth a little bit, but we become, as girls and then women, very consumed with these thoughts about negative body image and how that really takes away our attentional resources from other things. Do you have any memories or experiences of that where you felt that that was overtaking?
I would say probably. I can think back to one of the earliest times where I remember talking about the body. I was probably in third grade, and it was the first time that I said I was fat. As a third grader, I was an absolute twig. Like barely any meat on my bones. And so I was, of course, by standard definition, not overweight. And I'm not really sure where that came about. I think it's probably just what I had heard being said around me. And as I said it, I actually said it to one of my friends who, due to a medical condition, was a little bit more overweight. And my first thought was, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But, you know, I think that looking over like the years past that, it's definitely a distraction to academics. Megan Ramsey talks in one of her TED Talks how it affects young girls in academics, and it limits their desire to speak up in class because they don't want to be noticed. And I could definitely see that in myself throughout middle school and high school, not wanting to draw attention to myself if I didn't feel good about how I looked that day, because I didn't want people to turn and look at me in the classroom. And, you know, I know I'm not the only one, so I think it can be very detrimental to young girls to have that feeling about themselves and how it limits them, distracts them, and so on.
And that self-consciousness or thoughts and feelings about your body started as young as the third grade.
Apparently, yeah. And I don't know if I can't remember if I truly believe that about myself.
Right.
But it's what I said, and it was on my mind, and it was kind of, you know, growing up in a culture or an environment where there was so much focus on weight and image, you know, it was very prevalent for me.
Mm-hmm. I know that's a good point that you bring up is, does the child really believe it? Or is it a little bit of a superficial preference or superficial preference for thinner images or superficial preference for being thinner? And my memory could be completely off, but my memory of myself is that I didn't worry about my body until I was 19. So somehow I feel like I skated through. I think the last thing I, you know, really want to hit home on this point is that all of the things you're talking about are completely consistent with objectification theory. That's one of the major theories that explains the impact that living in this very objectifying society for women has on their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And, you know, that is that exactly what you said, starting as young girls, we get messages that we're valued for our appearance. And so we internalize that value. That takes our focus away from other things. It draws our attention to comparing our bodies with others. We're consumed by that. That leads to greater body dissatisfaction, and then perhaps a whole host of things like anxieties about our body, shame about our body. And some of the most interesting findings, I think, about that are things like the way it affects math performance. And there are studies showing that the more you objectify the body as a girl, it impacts your math performance. I mean, so imagine young girls, I think about this, young girls sitting in math class. The boys are studying math, and the girls are worried about how their legs look, you know, and that is the reality, very much so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's a vicious cycle, kind of like you talked about. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the factors that I'm most interested in my own research is the role of physical activity, both in terms of how it impacts body image, but also in terms of how body image impacts the choices and behaviors that we engage in related to physical activity. Can we start by having you tell us a little bit about what sports or physical activities you did growing up? I think of you now. I know our audience can't see you, but I did yoga training with you, and you just seem like one of the most capable, strongest, like physically strong and mentally strong women that I know. So tell us a little bit.
Thanks, Ann. Quite the opposite growing up. I played soccer from the time I was 3 years old until I started high school. And when I say played soccer, I do mean I sat on the sidelines the entire time. I was actually terrified to be put in. I didn't want to play because I was so uncoordinated and terrible at soccer. And so I didn't play in high school, but I attempted to run track. And I suffered an injury my freshman year. Actually got a stress fracture from running on tile floors. We didn't have a track. And so I tried to pick it back up, but when it came down to it, I wasn't fast, and I didn't have the endurance. So it kind of left me without a sport to compete in. And so without a sport to compete in all those years, I think I didn't view my body as strong and capable as, you know, you might view it now. And so for me, that definitely was like, well, then what is my body for? And one thing that you and I have talked about before is using my body in a way that isn't necessarily healthy. So
can I pause you there for a moment before you get into that? Because I just want to comment on I don't want to lose one of your earlier strands. How did you decide you were uncoordinated?
I couldn't kick. If you kicked a ball towards me, I missed. Like, if you throw anything towards me, I can't catch it. So the whole hand-eye-hand coordination, not my jam.
And then you said, I attempted to run track, and my first thought was, well, you just run track. I mean, anybody can participate. And you're like, how did you decide?
Anybody can participate. They didn't cut for our team, but I was always in the last heat, and we had a big team. So I ended up competing against people from my own team. We were in the last heat, and it was just kind of like, oh, we'll just put this group out here so they can do their thing and run. And I did run hurdles because that was something that was fun, but I wasn't fast, and I didn't have the endurance to run like a longer distance event.
I feel like somebody had to have been like giving you these messages, but that's a whole nother story. Before we get back on track, and you brought in Brené Brown, so I have to bring in Elizabeth Gilbert here, because I was rereading her book, Big Magic, on the process of creativity, and about halfway through the second time. And there's this one excerpt that just hit me, and I'm going to read the quote right now, and it's, ah, lovely adolescence, when the talented are officially shunted off from the herd, thus putting the total burden of society's creative dreams on the thin shoulders of a few select souls, while condemning everyone else to live a more commonplace, inspiration-free existence. And if you only substituted, so that's the whole quote, if you substituted physical activity or something like that for creative in that quote, it's the same thing. By adolescence, kids have either been told you're good enough to continue or you're not. And the ones who are not, and particularly for girls who have fewer sport opportunities, it's like you're left to just sit there and feel like you can't do anything functionally with your body. You are, there is nothing worthwhile that you can do with your body other than perhaps sit and look pretty.
Exactly.
Right? Sit and look pretty. There's that song out right now that I love. Sit still and look pretty. You guys, okay, I'm getting some nods. Yeah. So back to your story. Like, yeah, what do you do at that point?
So, you know, once I stopped being quite as awkward, so I got my braces off, and I started to get some attention from the boys. And I was like, oh, what is this? This is attention. This feels nice. Because, typically at that age, people pay attention to the athletes. I was fairly intelligent, but that doesn't really get you too far whenever you're 14 years old. And so I realized that, this attention was kind of like a little bit of a confidence boost. And it felt nice because I hadn't really had a whole lot of that before. There was no, like, high fives after winning a game or anything along those lines. And so I figured out that I could get more of this attention and more what turned out to be short, empty confidence boosts by just flirting and getting more attention that way. And so that continued to escalate. And by the time I finished high school, I was awarded the coveted senior superlative of biggest flirt. Every parent's dream, I'm sure. You know, you could be smartest or most likely to succeed, but
right.
No, I was the biggest flirt.
Yeah, and then that's classic. It's such a classic story, right? Mine went a different way, and because I had sport, right? And I think that's that cushion that protected me. And so if you don't have that, then surely you have the old standby that society values you, and particularly the opposite sex. If we think about traditional heterosexual relationships where the boys are going to value your appearance or the shape of your body, particularly in adolescence. All right, so one thing I know about you, hopefully this isn't an abrupt left turn here, is that in 2008, you were introduced to climbing. Can you tell us, so we kind of know a little bit about your sport history or lack thereof. What happened in 2008?
So I started climbing in college, and it turned out to be something that was a bit of a turning point in my life for a couple reasons. It absolutely redirected my career. I was in business school. I haven't worked in business, so I didn't go that route. And I think being able to see myself make improvement and accomplishments that were based on physical activity was really huge for my idea of self-efficacy. So climbing is rated by grades, so level of difficulty. The grades, the numbers in the grades get higher as the routes or the problems get more difficult. And so as I could actually see myself making progress, I felt more and more capable about what my body was able to do. And so I think then I finally had this feeling of strength beyond like any sort of mental strength, or I was book smart. I was physically capable of doing something other than attracting the opposite sex with my body.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Define self-efficacy for us. What does that mean to you?
To me, self-efficacy is that feeling of, if I can do this, then I can do that. So if I can accomplish this, I can do this climb. What else can I do? What else am I capable of in my life?
Well, that's the power of self-efficacy. Our textbook definition is your confidence to do a particular task, right? And it's really specific. But you're absolutely right in its practical application, is that if you have self-efficacy to do one particular physical pursuit, it may then generalize to other physical pursuits. You might be more likely, more confident to try other kinds of physical things. Mm-hmm. So it really was the progress that hooked you, the idea that you could see improvement, see progress?
Yes, yeah, it was the progress, but also just, you know, the accomplishment of, I can do this. It takes a different type of coordination than traditional team sports.
Yeah.
And I think, too, with the team sports, there's a social pressure of letting somebody else down, and I didn't have that. And so it was more of a me and the wall or me and the rock sort of activity, and really a lot of room for growth.
So do you think that fundamentally started to shift the way you talked a little bit about feeling like what your body was capable of in terms of body image more generally, going back to our early definition, did it change for you as a result of climbing?
I think yes and no. I think that with all of us, it's an ongoing process. So that was the turning point, and it definitely changed the way that I showed up in the world, the way I portrayed myself and my body and my worth. And so, yes, it was big picture. That's not to say that there aren't times where, you know, maybe even climbing is part of the problem where, you know, if I don't do what I want to do while climbing, then maybe I'm hard on myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's a whole nother story.
And that's more related to your performance as opposed to, like, what your body looks like when you're talking
absolutely.
About being hard on
yeah,
yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things, though, that you start to bring up, like returning to this definition of body image, is Tracy Tilka actually has done a lot of really good work recently on defining positive body image. And I love this definition and this concept. It has a lot to do with, it's multifaceted, but it has a lot to do with appreciation for the body, for what it can do, respect for the body, and viewing the body more functionally than aesthetically. And the real key here, too, is that it's not the absence of negative body image. So you can still have body dissatisfaction, but also have really good positive body image in terms of like the appreciation for what your body can do and how it feels and functions. And I think that's probably more realistic, perhaps, for most women, that we have a society that sends us messages constantly that make it really difficult for us not to be dissatisfied. But we can also, through things like climbing, build up this idea that our body is functional and capable as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important to note that, yes, positive body image is important, and it's totally normal to still have days where you just don't feel good about your body. I think that we also maybe give the message when we do talk about body image that you should love your body all the time, no matter what, and it's not necessarily realistic.
Right.
So I think acknowledging that, yeah, it's totally normal to just not feel great someday.
And what do we do then? But maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. So why do you think that these kinds of outdoor activities, whether it's climbing or mountaineering, are particularly important for women?
I think part of it is twofold. So the first part being that it does give you that ability to have a physical activity in your life that isn't necessarily the traditional sport that we were all kind of trained with whenever you go to middle school and high school, and for the most part it's team sports. And so I think it has an outlet for people to find new healthy hobbies that do get them to be physically active and to overcome physical and mental challenges. So I think that's very important. I think the other part is actually being in nature. It's really healthy. It can be at times relaxing. I'm not going to say that mountaineering and climbing is always relaxing, but that's part of it. It's whenever it's stressful and you overcome that and you walk away and you're like, wow, I did that. It helps you acknowledge that your body is strong and capable, and so is your mind.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of it. And I don't do what you do at all. I don't climb. I don't hike crazy mountains. But I like the idea of it from the perspective of it takes away some of those really standard bars that we use to measure our success in terms of what our bodies look like or what our bodies can do. You know, it's like do cardio at X percent of your heart rate 3 times a week for 20 to 60 minutes. It's like, no, define it for yourself. Like if you went out and you felt good about what you accomplished on the trail that day or on the mountain that day, do you think it helps you find your own definition of success?
I think so. I think that you might have something in mind, a goal in mind, you know, a climb you want to do, a mountain you want to climb, and you might not get it. And ultimately, stepping back and acknowledging what accomplishments came from that, honoring the small successes or the learning that comes from it is just as important.
All right, so you're talking about the John Muir Trail now.
A little bit.
So I know last summer, as we were finishing up our yoga training, you were getting ready to go on this massive adventure and hike some of the John Muir Trail. What do you want to tell us about that experience?
Well, Anne, what do you want to know about that experience?
Well, I know that from what you've told me so far, that you set out with very specific intentions and maybe came away with something completely unexpected. Is there anything you can touch on in there?
Yeah, for sure. So the John Muir Trail is 220 miles, and it's all in California, and it's up and down, lots of mountains. And so my plan was to hike the whole thing by myself, and it didn't really even occur to me that I might not finish. I didn't really train for it, but I was in good enough shape to be able to hike that far, I thought.
How long would that take?
I allotted about 17 or 18 days.
Okay.
Yeah. And a few days in, I just hit a wall. And it wasn't physical. It was actually like mental and emotional. I had these big realizations of why am I out here? If this isn't necessarily in line with my values, because I value connection more than I value anything else, and here I am alone, not connecting with anybody, because in the middle of the woods, and I, you know, pass people, but it's not a connection. So I got really lonely, and that was one of the reasons I left the trail. But I also felt already super accomplished. I had decided not to resummit Mount Whitney, and it would only have been an extra 4 miles. But I had 18 miles to do that day, and I had already summited Mount Whitney a few days prior. And I'm so stubborn and such a perfectionist that initially I was going to resummit because the trail technically starts at the summit of Mount Whitney. But I decided not to. As I was hiking towards it, I just realized, why would I do that? Mm-hmm. It was just there. You know, I have a lot more to do, and it's when I realized that I was connecting my self-worth with adventure. So when I speak of like, maybe you don't make the summit and that's okay, that's really what that moment was about. It was actually more of an accomplishment for me to not resummit because it showed that that's not what's important.
It feels like in talking to you a little bit about this in the past that there's been this like internal struggle for you where you really want to hang your self-worth or feeling of accomplishment on a very kind of external thing. Like I did that. I summited that. And what you just said to me about how that was more of a success, you may or may not be able to answer this, but my first part of my question is I'm curious, like, well, then what is that? Right? And is that a different form of perfectionism that's even better somehow? Like, what is that thing that makes you more successful? The thing it made me think about was the choices we make in yoga. Like, it's always about, it's never about getting into some arbitrary final pose that might be in Iyengar's book, mm-hmm. right? It's about what is the fullest expression for you in that moment, or do you need to just lay down in Shavasana and take a rest because that's what's truest for you in that moment? I don't know. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the connection here with yoga is that you're honoring your body and what you need in that moment. And what I needed in that moment and what I need in general is not a summit. And so, you know, that's where there's definitely a lot of intersection between the mindfulness in yoga and the mindfulness in a lot of outdoor activities. And I think that's one of the prominent ones of recognizing where you are, when it's time to stop, if you've already taken away something deeper and something that isn't an external factor, like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. I summited that mountain and that mountain. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that's more important? What did you learn from it? What experience did you have while climbing with friends and that sort of thing?
Yeah, what if like the definition of like positive body image was literally just honoring the body, right? And I think if we really truly honored our bodies, we'd probably do way more than we ever imagined and we would rest more. You know, we'd do both. It wouldn't go too far maybe in one direction or the other, but that it would be perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay, Mandy, so the way that I kind of want to close this episode is talking about solutions. You know, there's been a lot of body image programming out there, campaigns out there. I mean, it's not like we haven't attempted to fix this problem, you know, particularly for women. What do you think are some of the strategies or directions that we really need to go in to address body image concerns, particularly for women?
So a few things come to mind. I think first, having a community or a culture that is comfortable having conversations about body image. So you and I are both big Brené Brown fans, and she talks about shame and vulnerability and how you need to be vulnerable in order to develop connection. Mm-hmm. And so I think having these tough conversations with supportive friends or those around you can help provide a supportive network where you feel comfortable addressing body image and talking to people about it and really just getting out there. The more you keep it in, the more shame you feel about it and the more likely it is to kind of just fester. So conversations about it, I think...
Yeah, can I interject there with regard to that? So could you envision that creating some kind of safe networking, like on a college campus where, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Could you imagine bringing together people in that setting where you create safe communities?
Absolutely. It can be formal or informal, like a group of friends that start, you know, a little bit of a support group, or having a formal club on a campus, I think could be really, really powerful.
I've been kind of thinking about the club issue. But, you know, you bring up a really, when you talk about Brené, she's talking about real vulnerability. And what it made me think of, we just talked about this in my class this week, was fat talk. Do you know what fat talk is?
Absolutely.
So fat talk is like, oh, I look so fat in these jeans, in an attempt, like a feeble attempt, to get your friends to say, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. So it's like sort of voicing your discontent with the way you look, but it's not real vulnerability, right? It's like a cover. I don't know. That just like clicked in my head. It's like we're sort of engaging in this, and it's like almost a cry for help. Like I'm almost telling my friends that I really feel insecure about this, but in such a superficial way.
I think it is a way to tell your friends that you are feeling insecure, but I think the issue is with the response. You can just say, oh, no, you don't, and move on. Or you can say, well, why would you say that about yourself? Would you say that to me? Would you tell me you look fat in those jeans?
Right.
So I think really digging deeper into that opens up the outlet for a real conversation rather than something superficial.
Yeah. So, okay, quickly, the study that we read, it was so cool. They put it, you had to go in with a friend, and they put them in this fake texting situation. And so they weren't really texting their friend, but they thought they were. So the researcher would be texting them comments about these, like, images of celebrities. Well, here's what they found. So if the researcher started with, like, negative fat talk kind of talk, the person would reply with that kind of talk back. If they replied with a neutral comment, the person would reply with a neutral comment. If they said something more body positive, the person would reply with a more positive comment. Okay, why is that important? So if the researcher did like a fat talk comment, like, oh my God, she looks so bad in that outfit. I can't believe she wore that on the red carpet. then the other person was more likely to respond in a like manner, which led to body dissatisfaction. So it was like you engaging in the fat talk yourself, which you're more likely to do if your friend does, then leads to the body dissatisfaction.
And so that kind of gets at a second point that could be part of the solution is noticing what we say and just trying to speak more positively, saying more positive things about ourselves and others. We're very, very critical of ourselves, but also others. Mm-hmm. Anytime a celebrity goes out without makeup, they end up on a tabloid and they're really just thrown under the bus for it. And it's made like, oh, these people can't walk around without makeup. And so we can talk more positively about ourselves and about others. And then also whenever we do hear that negative body image conversation or the fat talk, rather than meeting it with more fat talk, noticing what we say and making it something positive.
Yeah, that's great. And at a minimum, raising awareness, right? Mm-hmm. Starts there. Great. What other things do you have? I know you've thought a little bit about this.
So I think, you know, in talking about outdoor activities and yoga, we need to introduce younger girls to non-traditional sports. Mm-hmm. And it might be getting it into the schools. And if schools can't afford it, there's organizations out there like She Jumps that strive to get young girls and women more involved in the outdoors. It's definitely a male-dominated field. 70% of regular rock climbers are male. And so it's not necessarily the most accessible thing or the most welcoming activity, but I think introducing girls to it at an earlier age can be really beneficial. They can start to recognize how strong they are and that their body is capable, that it's a vessel to allow them to do different activities rather than focusing on what it looks like. And along the lines of how we interact with young girls, I think complimenting them for more than their appearance is really important. It's very normal to say to a little girl, how cute is your dress? But also, or instead, recognizing something that they've accomplished or how brave they are, how smart they are, something about their personality.
Yeah, we think we mean well, and it's so conditioned in us that it's really hard. It's almost really hard to not say that to little girls, but there is research actually showing that that backfires, that even the positive compliments about your body backfire and don't necessarily support positive body image because you're still emphasizing appearance. So you're still promoting that idea of objectifying the body and leading to greater self-objectification in the young girl or the adolescent when you say those things. And again, people don't mean to harm people. I think by saying it, it sounds like a nice compliment, but you can turn that on its head. Let me ask you a little bit more about the alternative activities you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us any more about why you think that introducing those alternative activities is so important at those younger ages? What do you think it really does for them?
I think then they grow up with that understanding of their capabilities. And it might not be outdoor activities, it might not be yoga, it might be one of the traditional team sports. And I think that people just need to find whatever physical outlet it is that really supports them and their overall well-being and their feelings of self-efficacy or confidence.
Yeah, and not tying self-efficacy or confidence to some kind of normative or competitive standard. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I am almost thinking. Some of those outdoor activities and yoga in particular teach you a way to feel accomplished and competent and strong in your body, perhaps, that is not measured against others, not necessarily measured against a standard, though it can be, right? But in competitive sport, it's just so obvious. It's so obvious if you're in the starting lineup. It's so obvious if you're winning the game or winning the race or not. And so, you know, I wonder if those kinds of activities are particularly important for supporting a different way of feeling competent rather than just demonstrating competence relative to others.
Yeah, I think so too.
So are there any other solutions or strategies you want to share before we close?
I think the last thing I want to talk about, and it's much more big picture, so I'm not positive of the solution yet, is maybe it's just awareness, but media is definitely a huge culprit in this. And that's also us on social media, what we post and who we follow and how we view them. But I think we're constantly having that thrown in our faces. And I think we need to understand that there's so much of that that's photoshopped and not real. And ultimately, it's put out there because, you know, the people are trying to benefit from it. If they make us feel bad about how we look, then they make money. In Brené's book, she talks about how, you know, the hair industry makes $38 billion. The diet industry makes $33 billion. So people benefit from really making us feel bad about our bodies. And that's really powerful to understand that it's not the norm to look photoshopped. So that's really my final thought. And that's maybe a plea to media to consider how they're portraying women especially, but also for all of us to acknowledge that it's not always real.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there have been some strides made in the media, but it's just an uphill battle, mm-hmm. right? There's so much to conquer. One of the dilemmas that I've been pondering for, I don't know, the last good while is this idea that I think that positive body image really comes from feeling good in your body as opposed to any kind of perfect image of what your body should look like. So how do you create an image for that? Right? It's imageless. And yet, how do you advertise that? How do you promote that idea? Maybe there's a really clever idea out there. I feel like we're about to trip over it, right? A really clever campaign where we finally do get rid of the image. But even like the yoga world, how do we teach people? And we do, you know, we'll have a picture of a beautiful, quote unquote, perfect yoga pose, even in kind of the curvy yoga world. It's people doing amazing things. And then the tagline is, you know, something about doing what your body can do. And yet we're still holding it up to some crazy standard that very few people can achieve aesthetically to look that way in a particular pose. So it's, I don't know, it's always a paradox.
Absolutely.
Are there any final thoughts that you want to share?
You know, I think just to sum up everything, it really comes down to finding an activity, a physical activity in your life that supports you and makes you feel good about yourself and about your body, and helping you recognize that your body is much, much more than how it looks. And I think that's it. And, you know, maybe changing the conversation around some of this as well.
Yeah, and I think exactly what you said, that physical activity in whatever form it takes is a critical part of this equation, and that we're not going to get there just by telling people to look in the mirror and love what they see. Mm-hmm. Right? I think you have to live this transformation through physical activity. And we'll be talking about that lots more on future episodes. So I want to thank you so much. This has been so fun. I mean, we've been thinking about this for months, have we not? It's been awesome. And thanks for your time.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Moving Mindfully. I want to thank the College of Education at Washington State University for supporting this podcast. And I want to send a very special thank you to Maddie Roberts, my student who has been helping produce all of these initial episodes of the podcast. I could not have done this without her. Thanks to all of you for listening. Until we meet again.